The Guardian.
Hello, welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Today, the Champions League, Spurs come back, Liverpool and City score buckets, and PSG claps at the end in Madrid. Elsewhere, the FA get matey with Qatar, people play lots for the Premier League, and we'll look ahead to the FA Cup fifth round, round up the midweek games in the Football League, your questions, feedback corner, and that's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Hello, Barry Glendenning.
Hello, Max Rushton.
Lovely to see you.
And you.
Philippe Auclair. How are you?
I'm all right, Maxime.
Excellent news. And this heavyweight panel finished off by Jonathan Wilson.
Morning, how are you doing?
Yeah, marvellous. How are you?
Very well, thanks. Yeah.
Excellent. Which game would you like to start with? I've picked Juve Spurs because I thought it was the best football match. Are we in agreement with that?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, good. Was this a brilliant performance for Spurs, or are people just getting carried away with a draw, Jonathan?
I think it was a really good performance, and a really good performance from two points of view. I mean, the sort of between the sort of 15th and 80th minutes, they were much the better side than a team that's been in the Champions League final twice in the last 3 years and is second in Serie A. And if you think of where Tottenham were in Europe last season, that is a massive improvement. But it's also a great performance from a point of view of them being a complete shambles in the first 10 minutes, yeah, conceding twice, and still having the wherewithal and the self-belief not to panic, but to just settle down, start to play. And maybe Juve were complicit in that. Maybe Juve dropping off allowed them to do that. But, you know, to go 2-0 down to a team like Juve and come back to 2-2 and control sort of the middle two-thirds of the game, I think is incredibly impressive.
Juve had only conceded one goal in their previous 16, yeah, none in 2018. Spurs are the first team to wipe out a two-goal deficit since Juve moved into their new stadium in 2011. Buffon hadn't conceded a goal for 694 minutes.
I know. Extraordinary. Well, one question I have is whether the fact that Juve dropped down as they did was a choice or was also an incapacity to respond to that kind of high pressing, which is not really common in Serie A, and which Tottenham are becoming real masters at, and which, you know, they use that against... they seem to be very good at alternating phases when they can sit back, Spurs, and then, you know, go ahead and spring out, and other moments when they simply just asphyxiate the back line. And I'm just wondering whether some of it was proactive from Spurs, and what was from Juve, if it was a genuine game plan.
Allegri said, I didn't ask the team to go deep.
Well, there you go.
More than anything else, we were pushed back by Tottenham after that 25-minute spell where they pinned us back. We couldn't get back out.
Have you seen this? Khedira's statistics are absolutely astonishing. And we barely touched the ball, basically. He barely, you know, he's supposed to be there to also play the ball out of defence and put the foot on the ball, so to speak, and I can't remember, I mean, the exact numbers, but they are way, way down on what you would normally expect. So yes, you should really insist on the quality of the performance of Spurs rather than the fact Juve perhaps had an off day.
We talked on Monday about Moussa Dembele.
Whoa, whoa.
But Barry, it was almost like he just seems to be getting better every single game. I mean, by the end of the season, he'll be the best footballer on earth.
Yeah, it was astonishing. I mean, I did the minute-by-minute report for that, and I didn't really mention him that often, but that tends to be the case with those central midfielders. You know, you're focusing more on the action at the sharp end, but he's just got everything. He's fantastic. Him and Christian Eriksen were simply outstanding for Spurs.
Yeah, Eriksen was superb again, but Juve could have easily been 3-0 when Higuain had that left footed chance, and then he missed that penalty.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's defensive concerns there for Spurs, and I wonder, I mean, we don't quite know what's going on with Alderweireld, but I wonder if he had been available, whether they would have gone in with the three that they used in both games against Madrid and both games against Dortmund. And I think without that three, they lacked a little bit of cover, sort of. In, yeah, there were occasions when the two central defenders were exposed, which you ask questions about Eric Dier, maybe. But you think, had there been a third central defender there, one of them could have pushed out and could have prevented you just getting people getting a run on that line. So both the two goals came from that hole, you know, in front of the two central defenders. The second one, then Davis is sort of dragged too far across. So I mean, that would be the concern. And you know, that, I guess once you're 2-0 down, the parameters of the game change slightly. You can't really criticise a team for looking occasionally, and actually only occasionally, vulnerable on the break when you're chasing a game. And Aurier, I think, is always there's always a question mark there because he's so prone to making stupid tackles.
Why would you play him over Trippier? Just because he's slightly faster at running?
I would imagine so. I can't think of any other reason.
The only other thing I could think of is specific to Juve, the fact they play Mandzukic out on that side, so a big physical presence. Perhaps there's a sense that Aurier is more physically able to look after himself than Trippier. That if had Juve started launching long diagonals towards that back post, maybe Aurier would have been better able to deal with that than Trippier. But that's, I think Trippier's a better player.
Just to come back to Dembele, I mean, there's a part of mystery they said about the recent performances because he's no spring chicken. He's 30 years old. And what he's done over the last few games, I mean, I remember some performances early in his days at Fulham where he was incredibly impressive.
Well, the game away at United just before he moved, he was brilliant, wasn't he?
Yeah.
But that was in a much more advanced role. And that was where he played at RZ when he came to under Van Gaal.
So it's really late in his career when you think about it that suddenly everybody's talking about him. And I know people who work with him on the training ground have always said they call him the genius, and he's got all these amazing physical and technical qualities. He's got the capacity to glide past players as well as to force them off the ball. But the mystery is why it's taken so long in a way. He's had a few injuries, but not that many and not that serious that you would imagine it should have blocked him for so long. And the other interesting thing is that he's out of contract in 2019. So he's another one of those players that Spurs are going to have to sweet talk into staying for a bit longer, perhaps. The kind of performance that he had on that night is the kind of performance that make people talk in the whole of Europe, all the big clubs. Suddenly people say, well, he would really fit in here, he would really fit in there. There have already people saying he's the missing link for the PSG midfield, if I'm talking about France.
But would they sign somebody who'd be 31 by then?
They're the kind of club who might do
this
sort of thing.
Well, I suppose PSG might, yeah.
You've got players to come back, haven't they? So who do you think, Jonathan, would get through this second leg?
Oh, Tottenham definitely have an advantage. I mean, two away goals, a level game, going back to Wembley. I mean, it's not done and dusted by any means, but you'd have to say Tottenham are now marginal favourites.
Oh, Barry, you couldn't remember Jonathan's persuasive argument for away goals.
Yes.
Could you? But now Jonathan's here, we could ask him what his persuasive argument for why away goals should be banished. Or was it the other way around?
Yeah, he's against away goals.
I think it's a fundamentally illogical rule. I don't understand why it matters where you score the goal. The reason you play it over two legs is to give you 180 minutes rather than just 90 minutes. It's a slightly fairer contest. The number of games I've seen ruined by a goal being scored. You know, the away team is 1-0 up. Yeah, team A is at home first, wins 1-0, goes to the second leg, scores some freakish goal within the first 5 minutes, and suddenly if the home team has to score three, and they know they're not going to do it, and that game's completely dead. And the spectacle's ruined for this entirely arbitrary regulation. Now, perhaps it made sense in the sense of encouraging attacking play from your wayside when it was introduced back in the 60s, because back then there was a massive disparity between results at home and results away. Mm. Well, that disparity's got closer and closer and closer as time's gone by. Travel's got better, pitches have become more homogenised, it's less easy to intimidate referees, refereeing generally has got better. So all the reasons why teams used to go into the bunker have been removed. And I just think the mentality of away teams is no longer, let's get out of here with a 1-0 defeat, which is what it used to be. So what are you incentivising? You've just introduced a random element that, I mean, it's not unfair in the sense that both teams do know what the situation is, but it's unfair in the sense that one goal is worth more than another goal for no reason other than this crazy law.
It was introduced 52 years ago, Cup Winners' Cup, because there was a dearth of goals. And actually, if you look at it, I think you did, Jonathan, in some depth, if you look at the influence that it had as a rule change, it was not that massive, to be honest. And it's very strange. A goal is a goal is a goal.
I'm in full agreement. Spurs have tweeted this from their Twitter account today. On this day in 2011, we sealed a 1-0 victory over AC Milan at the San Siro. Do you want to hear the Tottenham team, 2011?
Luka Modric wasn't there?
No Modric.
No Modric. Gareth Bale?
No Bale.
My goodness.
Modric came on in the 62nd minute.
Okay.
For Van der Vaart.
Was Jason Kondi on it?
There was no Kondi. There was no Timothy Atuba. There was no Pamaro. Gomez, Galas, Dawson, Choluka, Asuakoto, Lennon, Van der Vaart, Palacios, Sandro, Pienaar, and Peter Crouch. Nico Kranjčar coming on in the 76th minute.
It would have been a long, long time to get that 13.
That could have been the whole... But producer Jonathan asks, was this a better or worse result? 1-0 in the San Siro with that team, or 2-2 at Juve with this team?
Well, I'd need to hear the Milan team, wouldn't we?
Abiati, Nesta, Thiago Silva. Is that Yepes?
Gattuso,
Gattuso, Seedorf, Flamini, Abate, Antonini, Ibrahimovic, Rubinho.
See, that sounds like quite a good team, but
doesn't it?
I bet it was quite slow. I think that team would have been great in 2008.
Okay, Real Madrid 3, PSG 1. Was this classic Real Madrid experience versus classic PSG blowing it, or was it more a game where either side could have won it and Real Madrid just happened to in the last 10 minutes?
I think it's a game either side could have won, a game PSG should have won, and a game you kind of knew they weren't going to win because they're PSG and they never do win. I never tire of seeing them lose. I love it. And when you're rooting for Real Madrid as the little guy, it's really come to something. It really has. You know, come on, you plucky little underdogs, Real Madrid. And it
those heartwarming stories of those part-timers.
Yeah, there. You know, dustmen, teachers, candlestick makers. It was fantastic.
Playing on a bog. Yeah. That's why PSG couldn't win.
Absolutely made my day. And I really hope and fully expect PSG to get tonked in the second leg. Teams winning 3-1 at home in the first leg in UEFA club competition have prevailed 255 out of 330 times. That's 77% strike rate. And then when you factor in the case that they're playing PSG, who are just gutless, absolutely gutless. It's their... No spine, no... Oh, they're comical.
Why do you hate them so much?
Pardon?
Why do you hate them so much?
Well, I just hate everything they stand for. You know, this Qatari PR wing that's been set up in Paris. They bear no relation to the PSG of yore. And the fact that they're so monotonously predictable in their relentless failure to do anything of note in the Champions League.
So it's a mixture of off and on the pitch. Because someone would say Manchester City, you know, the current Manchester City setup is nothing, is not the main road.
Paul
Dickhoff of yore.
I've said that. It's unrecognisable from the Manchester City.
But I don't detect that.
It's a completely different club. It just has the same name. But I enjoy watching Manchester City play. But I don't enjoy watching PSG.
No, that's
play.
The point, isn't it? That while I would have significant moral doubts about the ownership of both clubs, at least at City it's been used to facilitate this phenomenal experiment in how far you can push a style of football. Whereas at PSG, it's just let's buy some famous people and see if they fit together. I mean, I was genuinely shocked by how poor the general quality of the play was in that game. And you know, the commentators maybe seemed to be kind of, oh, this is brilliant. Well, lots of people doing tricks, but they didn't actually do anything. Yeah, there was not a single pass played between Neymar and Cavani. There was not a single pass played between Benzema and Cristiano Ronaldo. That's how little interaction there was in forward areas of the team, of the pitch between these teams. It was just individuals doing their tricks. It's this sort of celebrity culture that I think elite football could easily, you know, it's much easier if you're a director of a big club with all the money in the world, just go out and buy somebody who's famous and know that they'll generate revenue by nature of their celebrity. It's much harder to try and sort of harmonise that together into a team that actually functions and works. And the truth is that up to a point, it's still going to win games because they're really good players. But the level of football was, there was no cohesion. It was just, at the four goals, right? Three of the goals are basic defensive errors. Midfield is just standing there watching. The other goal is a midfielder getting badly out of position and then making a stupid tackle on a man who goes down very, very easily. I mean, it was a penalty, but you know, the quality of football was really, really low.
They were like kids chasing a ball around the schoolyard, just very good kids, but they're all following the ball. It needed someone to show a bit of maturity, put their foot on the ball and you know, have a look around.
Michael Carrick?
Maybe.
But
they have the players there who are capable of doing it. They just chose not to.
This is not necessarily just having to go at PSG. I mean, I thought Madrid were really poor as well. Yeah. So, for instance, Ronaldo, do you know how many times he touched the ball in the game?
20?
30.
30.
Do you know how many of those 30 touches were shots?
10.
10.
Like, 1 in 3 times he touches the ball is a shot. Like, he's not engaging in the play.
He's just got his hand on circle or square, whichever one it is.
You might as well like roll on a cannon and have somebody kind of feeding the ball into the cannon. But the cannon might actually kind of move about more and kind of get involved in the play a bit more.
Yeah. You know, I'm sort of the, in French you say le régional de l'étape, I'm the local lad, and I'm staggered. And I'm staggered. I don't know. Maybe I will have to sit on the fence, because should I pour some more boiling oil from the ramparts of foreign football morality on the hordes of Qatar?
You are welcome to, Philippe. And, you're and, you welcome know, to
I
do whatever you like.
I think the symbol of that game was a shot at the beginning of the, whatever it's called, the presidential thingy, where you had Nasser Al-Khelaifi sitting next to Florentino Perez, the man who stands to make billions on the building sites of Qatar, next to whom was standing Nicolas Sarkozy, the corrupt French president. And I thought, this is a perfect, you know, this is we've got it. This is the game that we're going to watch. Fantastic, isn't it? And I agree with, I think that the quality of the game was really, really poor.
So are these two bad teams?
If you compare, for example, what we saw between Juve and Spurs.
A different level.
Different level altogether. I was also thinking, if you want, or for example, City-Napoli, which were the two games, were absolutely phenomenal, played at a level in terms of organisation, imagination. Neymar, the guy he passed the ball the most times is Dani Alves,
his mate. Yeah.
8 times. And you get the feeling that, judging by the atmosphere in and around the PSG camp, you get the feeling that for some players, it's a bit like it's a celebrity show. It's like, I'm a footballer, get me out of here.
I have a
Thiago Silva was left on the bench. Why? Nothing to do with footballing reasons, even if he's a bit flaky in some of those big games. But it's also because of his relationship is not great with some others in the team. Like Adrien Rabiot had said a few things about him, which were not very nice.
That Rabiot interview after the game was really interesting.
That was very pointed, wasn't it? When referring to the 8-0 victory over Dijon.
And, yeah, saying these are actually the games, so we have to stand up and be counted.
Yeah. And he actually had been one of the better performers in that particular game, Rabiot. And he's one who can actually put the foot on the ball. But otherwise, you looked at it, it looked completely, I don't know. I was trying to understand, for example, speaking from Real Madrid's point of view, what on earth is the game plan here? I don't understand what's going on. I've no idea. Okay, they're like this 4-4-2. Marcelo is a fantastic player. What's new? But how were they supposed to build attacks? How were they defending? The number of times when you had last-ditch interceptions, players throwing themselves to intercept the ball and say, oh, that's a great defensive act.
What's
no, they were just in the wrong bloody place to start with.
Thiago Silva was left out. He took to Instagram to write, God help me to improve. Thiago Silva's wife took to Instagram to criticise Unai Emery's tactics. Angel Di Maria's wife took to Instagram to say extra effort, goals, assists, form equals bench. So it was a fun day on social media.
Neymar's clearly at the epicentre of this. All that stuff about his birthday. The club put on a 2-day.
Yeah.
Three days?
Yeah.
Oh, I only got invited to 2. I didn't know about that.
Third day was the best.
Say that again. Neymar had a three-day birthday party.
The PSG put on a birthday party. I mean, obviously, after the Yaya incident, everybody's now terrified of not recognising a player's birthday enough. So, yeah, I thought it was 2 days, but 3 days maybe,
Unai Emery left after he got the cake, by the way. He wanted to make sure that the cake had been delivered.
And we know that, I mean, Rabiot referred to privileges, didn't he? Which obviously, again, was referring to Neymar. And there's a little bit of me has a slight sympathy for Neymar in this year of all years. So he's expected to win the World Cup for Brazil. You know, the judging in the Rio Carnival finished early. And you're judging the Rio Carnival's a big thing. Finished early so he could get home to watch the game. Yeah, that's the level of focus on Neymar. But he seems to have reacted to that by thinking that every game he has to get the ball, beat 10 men and score. So he completed more dribbles in the game yesterday than the rest of his teammates put together, and more than twice as many as any Real Madrid player. Mainly because he just doesn't use the ball very well. I mean, none of those dribbles actually produced anything. It was just him getting the ball and running. And he should have been sent off.
For diving, yeah. Steve Claridge for Cambridge used to just get the ball and just keep it and run all the way across the pitch and then all the way back across the pitch.
But they did call him the Neymar of the Fens, didn't they?
They really did. They had that sort of style and grace as well. Cavani, he took two kickoffs, had five other passes, one of which was forwards, and one blocked shot in his 66 minutes. I mean, I have sympathy for centre-forwards. If you don't get the ball, there's not a lot you can do. You just run around a lot. And then when you get it, you're so tired that you don't know what to do.
Well, if you were watching on BT Sport, he had an awful lot more involvement because Darren Fletcher thought him and Rabiot were the same person on commentary. Because they've slightly similar hair, you know, it's easy enough, well, mistake to make, but that was quite amusing. I mean...
Did you hear, by the way, to finish off on this birthday, what Wagner Ribeiro, Neymar's agent, said when he was asked if there was a chance of Neymar moving to Real Madrid next season? He said, what? They'd never allow him to live like he lives in Paris. There you go.
From the way you guys are talking, would any team going through want to play one of these two sides because they're not actually very good?
Well, they are. Real Madrid are pretty good. They must have something. They've won a few things recently in Champions League.
I'm not sure they're that good. I mean, to be fair to Zidane, okay, I've got a slightly conflicted opinion about Zidane. So the reason that I'm kind of sceptical of him is that Real Madrid have only kept one clean sheet in the last 10 games. And around this time last year, they had a similar run where they kept going behind and having to drag themselves back into games. And you can get away with that when Ronaldo's scoring 50, 70, 80 goals a season. He's not doing that at the moment. I know he got two yesterday, but, you know, a penalty and one that bounced in off his knee. Ronaldo, and I know he got a hat-trick at the weekend, but apart from those five goals in the last two games...
Bouncing off the knee, I think that's...
No, he bounced in off his knee. I mean, it's a terrible goalkeeper.
He just needed one to go in off his knee or something, Baz.
It was a kind of Pipo Inzaghi kind of goal. Okay.
Ronaldo, while still an extremely good player, is not the player he was last season. Age is slowly sapping at him. And he's become, as I was saying, this very sort of static presence. So my point is that Zidane's teams do not control games. They allow games to sort of become chaotic. Players are given probably too much freedom, and the result is that Real Madrid do win the majority of them because they've got very good players. But it's not you're not ensuring that, you're not taking control of it. Having said that, Zidane's substitutions made a massive positive difference last night, and Asensio, who's been brilliant every time I've seen him, was responsible for the second and third goals, and he probably should be more famous. And if he was more famous, he'd probably get to start.
How can he get more famous?
By starting. Oh.
There was one incident, I think it was in the first minute of that game, where Bershish fouled, or looked to foul Tony Cruz in the PSG penalty area, and the ref was putting the whistle to his mouth, had a good long look, and then decided not to award the penalty, enraging Real Madrid's players in the process. And it occurred to me that was clearly taken a decision made on advice from the guys behind the goal, who a lot of pundits insist don't do anything, but I would suggest they made
That's
a big decision
point,
there.
Yeah, I hadn't thought. I mean, the decision was clearly right, yeah, not to give a penalty. I mean,
refereeing has come in that particular game has been the object of a number of discussions. Well, I don't call them discussions, of complete paranoiac ditherings by people in France, where they say, oh, it's pretty obvious that referees, you know, after what happened against Barcelona last year, that there is almost like a conspiracy by UEFA to prevent disturbing the established order, and, you know, very much in favour of Real Madrid. But that gives you an idea of the elevation of the debate around the game and how... It is actually, I think, really prejudicial to PSG, the fact that everything, it's not just everything gets blown out of all proportion, it's just this complete nonsense. There are 8 pages in L'Equipe today about this game. 8, plus countless pieces online. I have yet to read a single analysis of actually what happened. It's all about, can they win the next game? Was the referee bent? Not in exactly those terms, but pretty much it. Was Neymar shite? Was Ronaldo good? This sort of thing. And there's absolutely no analysis whatsoever, which L'Equipe can do and do very well. But when it's PSG, a fuse blows, and the power to have any kind of intellectual fair discourse about them disappears. That's not good for them. And that explains why they're so flaky. That's one of the reasons why.
All right. That'll do for part one. We'll be back. I was about to say something about how we didn't have any intellectual insight, but actually, I think we did. So,
we did?
Yeah. So well done us. We're the best.
We used numbers and everything.
Yeah, we did.
I had a stat.
Yeah, you did. Have we ever been? Was that the best 15 minutes we've ever done?
I did a sum today.
You did a maths and maths?
Well, I divided two numbers.
Oh, what,
to
which
come
ones?
Up with the percentage, just so you know, the 77%.
Guys, well done, everybody. Let's see if we can recreate that in part two. Welcome back to Guardian Football Weekly Extra. We'll do Liverpool and City's wins in a second, but some admin. We've got a live show on the 27th of February in Dublin. Me, Jonathan, Barry, joined by Barney. There are a few tickets remaining, but it could well be a sellout, which is exciting, isn't it? We'll put a link underneath the podcast. Will you be in charge of all social activities, given it's your homeland, Barry?
I haven't really been out in Dublin for a very long time.
Will you be mobbed in the street?
No.
Oh.
I don't know where the hip places to go are anymore. I can bring you to all the grotty pubs I used to drink in back in the mid-90s, if that's any good to you.
We've also got a live show in Copenhagen, May the 10th, the same day as the Danish Cup final. Carsten writes, front row tickets bought today. I'll be the one wearing a Barry Glendening Forever t-shirt. Trolls Jensen replied to the announcement with, tickets bought, I'm going to sit and bask in Barry's bitterness. Looking forward to it. Porto 0, Liverpool 5. Porto's biggest home defeat in European history. They're top of the Portuguese league. How impressive a result is this, Jonathan?
Oh, very impressive, I think. I mean, Porto, I mean, clearly they're not at Liverpool's level, but they're not useless either. And I think for Liverpool to put the game absolutely to bed in the first leg is hugely impressive. Porto didn't play very well. I only saw the highlights, but they didn't look to play very well. But Liverpool were as ruthless as they have been for, 3-4 months?
Yeah.
So, yeah, they're, when they get on the roll, the pace of that forward line, I think...
How do you defend against a team that breaks that quickly? I mean, the third goal was... I didn't count how many seconds, but...
What is remarkably remarkable, it's also when you see them break, is the runs they make. I don't know of any other team which does this kind of thing, because it's obviously there's a huge part of improvisation and feeling instinct what you want, but it all makes complete sense. And then suddenly it's like somebody changing the geometry all of the time, and it's, you know, you don't know what to do.
Well, it can't be that improvised. I mean, they must practice that, right?
No, that's what I mean. But it's obviously, it's a framework in which they have great freedom, you know, to express themselves, their right. Perhaps it's the fact that they are players whose qualities are not actually quite comparable. They're very different types of players.
Yeah, they're sort of mutually, they fit together. Yeah,
absolutely.
But especially since, you know, when Coutinho left, they all said, worry.
I think we talked about it. It's like Coutinho was the least Kloppian player of the lot. So in a way, that does make some sense.
But I also think people, I think where Coutinho may still be missed is against a deep line defence when you need somebody to kind of create something in a small pocket. In terms of those rapid breaks, you know, he's expendable.
Makes you wonder why Porto didn't defend it. Once they're 2-0 down, I guess it's different, isn't it?
And also, you know, home game in Europe, you kind of, you know, the if they had done what Newcastle did against Manchester City, for instance, how would people have reacted? How would the Portuguese press have reacted? I think Porto have a sense of themselves as as at least in the home leg, they should be able to take the game to the opposition, and perhaps hadn't quite appreciated just how rapid and ruthless Liverpool can be.
It's not just about the front three. I mean, some other players had were excellent. Milner was terrific. Yeah. And actually, you wonder
and
why
Robertson
he's not used.
Well.
Yeah, Van Dijk is starting to bed in and to look like the Van Dijk, you know, from two seasons ago. Massive improvement, that is. So, yes, and you wonder how far they can go, because they're the ones, honestly, they're a bit frightening, aren't they?
James Milner has the most assists in the Champions League this season with 6. Dele Alli and Kevin De Bruyne joint second with 4. I mean, he's a sort of classically underrated footballer, James Milner.
Not by us.
No?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
The man whom Fabio Capello said was the future of English football, if I remember well.
Andy asks, is it time we appreciate Roberto Firmino as the excellent centre-forward he is? Should he be in the Kane, Suarez, Aguero, Lewandowski, Cavani best striker in the world conversation? Although, bearing in mind what we said in part one, Cavani's not in that question anymore.
No, because although he's a really, really, really good player, and although he fits our system perfectly, he's not really a striker in the same sense. You know, his job is sort of to drop off and to create opportunities for others. So I think he's a fantastic player, and I think he's hugely important to Liverpool. But if you're talking about great strikers, you're talking about, you know, number nines who score goals, and he does a slightly different job.
While scoring loads of goals.
Yeah. Well, yeah, yeah, yeah.
21 now, something like that, this season, which is...
And amazing teeth.
Yes.
Really. Shiny, pearly white.
Blinding.
Yeah.
Really.
You think you can't stare directly at them?
You know, there's one thing that puzzles me about Roberto Firmino. Sometimes he looks like Michael McIntyre.
He does a bit.
Yeah.
Basel 0, Manchester City 4. Jonathan, can you tell me anything exciting about this match?
I mean, I watched the highlights because I was watching the Juve Spurs game. City looked... I mean, they looked like they had a slightly shaky sort of opening 15, 20 minutes.
Did,
and then
yeah.
once they got going, they were just streets ahead, as I think you'd expect them to be. So it's good for them, as it is good for Liverpool. They essentially got the game done in the first leg. I'm not sure it's very good for European football that we're seeing scores of this magnitude at this stage of the competition.
Yeah, you expect to see them in the group stages.
Do expect to see them. I'm not sure we should expect to see them even there, I think.
Well, the disparity between the haves and the
sure,
haven't
but,
quite
my,
as much
my
as
argument as would be that disparity is itself a bad thing.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Sorry.
There were some moments, because I watched the game. Well, I watched both. Tried, you know, to do one of those stereo viewing things. And they were, as you could expect, terrific going forward. Created a huge number of chances. Great news for them is that Lawasane and Silva, David Silva, are back, which is a big fillip. But I found them quite shaky at times defensively, to be honest. And Bale had a number of chances, actually, which against a tougher opponent, I think, would... I don't know, it reminded me a bit what happened against Monaco in the Champions League,
mm-hmm.
where you think, okay, loads of chances created, fantastic players on the ball and so forth. It's a better Manchester City team, we all know that. But there were some frailties at the back, but honestly, that's really nitpicking because, I mean, 4-0 away
well,
from
I
home.
Well, I also wonder whether it's sort of it's inherent to the way they play.
Yes,
so you
indeed.
You can't have both, and so the payoff of having the great fluent attacking football is that your defence is exposed at times. Yeah. And I think the game between Liverpool and City, both teams showed the advantages and disadvantages of playing those styles.
The thing, I don't know if you'd agree with me, but one big change is that we're finally seeing this season teams from the Premier League who are actually putting into action ideas which we've always thought should be put into action in European football, i.e. we're seeing them imposing the kind of pressure, particularly pressing-wise, in the case of three of them. I wouldn't say that of Chelsea and Manchester United, but the three which have done extremely well, and which it seems that other European teams are not prepared for, and which seems to have become the norm now in the Premier League, that you're expecting those teams to have this incredibly energetic high press, high tempo, physicality.
Do you think
so
that?
Forth.
Do you think because
that's new?
There was
that
almost too much respect from the English sides previously.
No, I think it's a conjunction of coaches coming from the continent who are bringing in tactical nous and all the rest. You know, we're talking Guardiola, Klopp, and Pochettino here. A new breed of English players who are tactically more aware, because many of these teams also have a number of English and British players in their ranks. You think of Andrew, Robertson, for example, absolutely wonderful, and Alexander Arnold with Liverpool. And it's a fusion of both, and it's extremely efficient. And I was looking, as I want to do, at Mr. Cassie's coefficients table, and it's absolutely astonishing that, you know, English clubs have now gathered 16.5 points at this stage of European competitions. It's completely unheard of. No other league has ever accrued as many points in the history of UEFA rankings as English clubs have to this point.
But there's also a strange reversion going on, that when English clubs did dominate Europe late 70s, early 80s, it was by playing this aggressive, the pressing game as it was then, which obviously has become more sophisticated, but they were physical, they were quick, they did press. And then post-Heysel, post the ban, there was this sort of idea that to compete with the Europeans, you had to play in a European way, which meant slowing it down, it meant holding possession. Mm-hmm. And of course, that had been part of Liverpool's success, that they were able to kill games by just holding the ball. But we sort of lost sight, I think, of the value of that aggression, that high press. And it's actually something Klopp talked about when he got here. He was asked about his style and that high tempo approach. And he said, well, I learnt this watching English teams in the late 70s, early 80s. He sort of brought it back. So, it does feel that a cycle's been completed and we're back to... I mean, I'm not saying English teams are necessarily going to dominate the way they did 40 years ago.
Just realised how old you are.
Yep.
Here's a question from Nobby. Salah, De Bruyne or Kane, who would you pick first on your team sheet?
That's a good question.
Who else is in my squad?
It's the Tottenham squad from 2011 who beat AC Milan.
I'll have Assu Okoto in first.
I think I would pick De Bruyne, but it would be a very tough choice between him and Kane.
I would also pick De Bruyne, I suppose, but...
When I first looked at the question, I said, but League Two, you'd pick Harry Kane, because he'd still get you 30 goals. But De Bruyne would get bypassed, I think.
Yeah, I mean, context is important. Mm. I'd go De Bruyne, but also partly because the pathologist in Mawson Endeavour is called, De Bruyne, which I guess is a corruption of the same name. So were there a murder, I think he could probably ring his dad, who could come and sort it out.
Chelsea play Barcelona next week in the Champions League. They beat West Brom 3-0 on Monday night. Could have been very different, Philippe.
It could have been. There could have been. There was a very strong penalty appeal for West Brom early in the game. And it was, again, it was disjointed performance from Chelsea in front of a quite enterprising West Brom team. I suppose they're in a position where they've got to take some risks. But it was not entirely convincing, certainly nothing as convincing as the scoreline would suggest. I mean, decent debut by Giroud, a bit rusty, but wonderful assist.
It was a lovely touch, wasn't it?
It's absolutely gorgeous, and it's one of the things that he does so, so well in league play. And obviously there is a relationship there with Eden Hazard, which is already excellent. I mean, they were constantly looking for each other. That's promising. Otherwise, there's a lack of rhythm and tempo in that team at the moment. They look leggy, as I think is the English expression. When you compare this kind of performance with what we saw, for example, against Atletico away from home, where you had this real zip in the passing, don't have it anymore.
Some players really suit a bandaged head, Terry Butcher, etc.
I'm not sure.
Giroud made his head look really long, didn't it? Perhaps more importantly, are West Brom doomed? They're slightly adrift.
Well, they're 7 points from safety now, aren't they? Mm-hmm. I mean, they're not definitely doomed, and they definitely are playing a little bit better than they were sort of a month or so ago. But unfortunately for them, Swansea are playing a lot, lot better. Huddersfield have suddenly had this... Well, they've suddenly won 2 games 4-1 on the spin, one of them in the cup. They seem to have hit a patch of form.
And West Brom couldn't sack Alan Pardew because they only just got him, so they decided to sack the board, didn't they? They sacked their chairman, John Williams, chief executive Martin Goodman, placed them on gardening leave. Quote, these changes follow Albion's poor results this season, which currently see the club at the bottom of the Premier League. Mark Jenkins is returning to the club as to be CEO. He previously held that role for 14 years. There's much to do, but for now the focus must be solely on the remaining games of the season.
I mean, I think it's Pardew arrived late November at the club, and since then they've won one game. One. in the league.
So why are they sacking?
That was against Brighton, wasn't it?
Why are they sacking the CEO?
It's difficult to know what sacking the CEO will do, but I don't think it happens often, half often enough. You know, fans have long, through the medium of song, attempted or, you know, called for the board to be sacked, and they seem to be answerable to no one. So it's kind of refreshing to see that a chairman an owner is taking action. What it will achieve, only time will tell.
Sad news about Ryan Mason, wasn't it? Forced to retire. Yeah. It happened on Tuesday. It was a result of the fractured skull he suffered against Chelsea in 2017. He clashed with Gary Cahill. Gary Cahill, amongst many people in the game, to sort of tweet their sadness. Gary Cahill said he was devastated by it. Ryan Mason's decision,
as it no doubt is, by the way, I mean, it must be something very difficult to live with.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. And then Petr Cech sent
a
great message as well, didn't he? Pochettino has said the door's open at Tottenham with whatever he decides to do next. It's interesting. Mason, I think he scored a winner at Sunderland and broke his foot, I think, at the time in sort of 10 minutes to go. And that he was ahead of Dele Alli. I mean, that's where his standing was at the time as a footballer. But just very sad news that he's had to retire. There's a Paul Pogba-Jose Mourinho argument happening at the moment. Pogba reportedly exchanged words with Jose, demanded a change in United's formation to grant him more freedom. La Keeper are running a similar article when they're not.
The source of that story, though, is intriguing.
Exactly what I was going to say. Go on.
The source is somebody who is known, shall we say, to be quite close to the Mourinho camp. And that would suggest to me that Mourinho's quite happy for that story to be out there. I can't quite work out why that would be.
So we think Jose's leaked this?
Jose's people, I would say, have probably okayed it, yeah. Which is odd, but
Sean asks, why won't Jose go back to 4-3-3 to accommodate Pogba? Worked pretty well at Chelsea.
Thing to do, yeah.
And Inter. We all think he should do that.
Well, he could try it. It's a bit this kind of Pogba-centrism is weird. It's like it's all about Paul Pogba, as if every single problem Manchester United has or doesn't have is related to Paul Pogba.
Well, that's true, but on the specific issue of a 4-3-3...
That is correct, yes.
Like, they don't really have it. I mean, I know Jesse Lingard's been playing very well as the 10.
Yeah.
But he doesn't seem to have played as well since Sanchez came in. If you played a 4-3-3, you then have it's easier to accommodate Sanchez as a central player rather than Lukaku. But I think the issue they have is they don't really have another midfielder. So you have Matic, you have Pogba, and then who plays on the right? Herrera can do it, but I don't think
Carrick would be a possibility some of the time, perhaps. But the other problem that it leads to is that three attacking positions left. Alexis, you have to play him, which leaves two.
It's I mean, it's almost like the squad hasn't been put together with any thought of how they might play together.
Oh, my wonder there. Who was talking about chief executives a second ago? Sorry.
No, I was going to say the Manchester United Supporters Trust has met the club as well to discuss improving the atmosphere at Old Trafford. It's easy to see that and to sort of laugh at that as if a meeting can a meeting, you know, just doesn't sound right, does it? You can't meet to say, let's have a really good time tonight. Well, you know, like, hopefully it just happens.
No, but it's easy to laugh at it. Mm. But you could, for example, say, is the stewarding a little bit too tight, a little bit too aggressive? If you jump, you know, if you're standing in your seat, you start bellowing chants or whatever, does somebody tell you, sit down? I've seen that happen in Premier League grounds.
Or is there a way of getting like-minded vocal people in the same part of the ground? I mean, I think Old Trafford generally actually needs an overhaul. You know, it feels like an old ground now when you go to it. The press facilities are significantly the worst of obviously Tottenham and Chelsea, we assume, will improve when they get the new stadiums. But of any top six side, United's press facilities are the worst. And I know people, or journalists, who cares, and up to a point they're right, but I think that's reflective of generally the facilities and amenities at Old Trafford are less good than at other top grounds.
The other thing as well is that in terms of away support, the Manchester United away support is one of the most vocal that you could possibly hope for or fear. And then when you're at Old Trafford, for some reason, it can be really, really flat. It can be, on occasion, it's been great, by the way. I mean, it has been. I've been there a few times this season. There have been occasions when, honestly, I didn't think it was a library at all. But too often it is, yeah, really, really flat.
But without wanting to pick on Old Trafford, because it's far from alone in grounds like this, it's full of tourists and day trippers and middle-aged men who don't sing. The kind of people who would generate an atmosphere can't afford to go. So if you want to create an atmosphere, lower ticket prices. That's not going to happen. So the Man United Sports Trust and club officials.
You say that the quietest ground I've gone to this season, the last season, is the Etihad Stadium, where the tickets are cheap. Tickets are cheap at Manchester City. You look at the season tickets; it's like what, 250 to 300 quid, which is, you know, is a lot of money in itself, but compared to some other,
it's very affordable.
Is that an expectation thing?
City, there's still an issue. Of an aging demographic going to games. So, I mean, it's a while, I admit, since I saw these stats, but I remember talking to a director at City, and you probably know who the former director,
yes.
You probably can work out who it is.
Mm-hmm.
And he was saying that they were panicking because the average age of a season ticket holder in a decade had gone up by 8 years. Essentially, it's just the same people.
Wow.
They weren't getting anybody new coming in to buy season tickets. Now, I admit that is a while ago, but I think all Premier League clubs have had a similar issue that, you know, in the 70s, a lot of people at the grounds would be late teens, early 20s, and now that's not the case.
And maybe the Supporters Trust can also start talk about safe standing, perhaps in sections of Old Trafford, which seems to generate almost automatically a betterment of the atmosphere.
Speaking of which, by the way, did you see? I don't think we mentioned it on Monday. Coventry got 28,000 to the Ricoh Arena last weekend,
and they were doing
a match against Accrington.
Yeah, they were doing a cheap ticket.
I think cheap and free promotion just to get kids in and get them to see what football's all about. Because I think it is a major source of concern because attention spans are getting a lot shorter, aren't they these days? People don't watch full games; they watch highlights, they watch vines, they watch clips on YouTube and Twitter, and you know, I think there's so many other things to do, you know, watch gamers on YouTube channels, watch you've got Netflix, you know, I've recently got on the Netflix, like, it's just overwhelming how much stuff there is. I'm trying to figure out, like, making lists of stuff I want to watch. And I'm worried I'm going to die before I get to it. That's why I've quit smoking.
So you can watch all of The Sopranos and The Wire.
Yeah. So I can see a problem in 10 or 15 years that people are just losing interest. Plus, people are being priced out of watching it on TV as well, you know.
Talking of that, Premier League rights package.
Mm-hmm.
Seven packages of fixtures. Sky have got Saturdays 5:30 and 7:45. They've got Sundays at 2 and 4:30 p.m. They've got Monday nights and Friday nights. BT have got Saturday at 12:30, 32 games they've got. Sky have committed to 3.6 billion. So it's down from what they did last time. They're saving £600 million compared to the last deal. Does this mean anything? I mean, there's still two more packages to go somewhere, which could go to Amazon or Netflix. You mentioned more pressure on you, Barry.
I think an estimate of the money that these last two packages would go for, which are the midweek games, basically, more or less, is about £400 million. So it will be a slight compression of the previous deal, which was exceptional because of the competition between BT Sport and Sky. But interestingly, the deals for broadcasting abroad are up, which is one thing I've hardly seen mentioned anywhere. Like, for example, the deal for the US is plus 50%.
Yeah.
China is plus 50%. And they're hoping as well to hit it big in other parts of the world. I think also Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, is a massive increase.
Yeah,
so I think the things, it will stay at the same level.
When Sky did their rejig of the channels, and which was, 6 months ago or something like that?
Start of this season.
Start of the season. And there was, I think it was evidence the first sort of 4 or 5 weeks of the season that viewing figures were down. And so, yeah, I spoke to a few people and they said that they weren't particularly worried about this round of talks. It's the next one where they think there might be a significant hit. So what they were saying was, rather than being $5 billion for domestic rights and $3 billion for overseas, they're expecting roughly 6 and 5. So we go from 8 to 11. Well, it hasn't gone up to 6. It's probably gone down slightly, but the overseas rates look like they're going to go up by 50-60%.
Yeah.
So I don't think anybody's too concerned yet, but I think there is concern for the next load of rights.
I saw a petition the other day for, you know, saving grassroots football, and I think it's about get the Premier League to put 5% of their profits or something to grassroots. And it's easy to bash the Premier League. I think they do quite a lot of good things. How do we feel about what their contribution should, what it should be? Because
compared to other leagues, they do an awful lot more.
I find this very, very difficult, because what are we doing? We're knocking a business for being successful. Like, I mean, obviously, it'd be lovely if they invested 5% or 10% or 15%, and you kind of, whatever figure it is never going to quite seem enough. So, yeah, it would be great if they invested more. But I also think they're kind of within their right to say and go, well, not really to do with us. And anything they do give is a bonus. And I think it's quite easy for people to hide behind the Premier League and the money it makes. When you're talking about lack of facilities for kids, that's to do with government. That's to do with schools having to sell off playing fields. So, it would be fantastic if the Premier League subsidised that. But I don't think they're under any sort of obligation to do it.
And also the Premier League is not, as a body, is a private limited company. It's entirely up to the clubs. It's not the Premier League as an entity which decides, no. The Premier League, you know, you've got meetings, you've got a two-thirds majority to take the decisions, and you have discussions. It's not Scudamore who decides, who tells them, you're going to do this, you're going to do that. No, it doesn't work like that. It's a very strangely democratic process. Yeah. So it's up to the clubs themselves to do that. Some of them do more than the others, but there's nothing that prevents them from investing the cash. And the other thing, you've also got to be in a position where you can invest the cash. These clubs are now profitable. Up until very recently, they were not. They have huge debts. Some of them have huge debts. They've got to balance the books. So the money, rather than take the figure, the Premier League is worth like £8 billion in broadcasting rights over 3 years. Well, okay, £8 billion, which are spent that way, what's the profit? You know, again, I think it's a little bit simplistic to paint them as the bad guys.
Well, I think it's simplistic in the fact that it's quite easy to just put the Premier League, the FA, the PFA, agents, footballers earn, you know, there's a disparity between people with lots of money and people with no money. And that's probably true in society as well. On that PFA note, just before we finish this part, Gordon Taylor's salary came out. Yeah. Pretty staggering.
Well, it's not staggering, because we've known that he gets ridiculously overpaid. He's been overpaid for years. So I don't think anybody should be surprised by it. But I also, who are the people to whom he's beholden? It's the players. I don't think the players worry that somebody's earning £2.5 million a year, because for them, that's chicken feed. I mean, I guess that's not fair
on lower
league footballers. And maybe they should be a bit more militant in saying, hang on, what are you actually doing for this?
But do you think they can't do that? I mean,
well, why not? I mean, a union, presumably they have voting rights. I mean, that's how unions work, right?
It's as if, he was he was still getting a bonus for the deals that he negotiated very well, by the way, with the Premier League and the league when he was at the beginning, which has got a lot of money coming into the PFA. And I don't know.
Other converse argument is, if somebody wanted to pay any of us £2 million, we'd probably just go, I'll have it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he's not evil for taking it. It's just there's something wrong that he's been offered it. He's been in that role for me. He was in that role.
1980s.
I was doing a documentary with ITV4. I mean, I'm a very small part of it, which will be on in March, about the lifting of the restrictions on foreign players in 1978. And the PFA rep who's complaining about it is Gordon Taylor. He's like Wenger. He's just never going to go.
1981.
Thank you, Philippe. Right. All right, look, that'll do for part two. In part three, we'll look ahead to the Europa League, the FA Cup fifth round, back in a tick. Welcome back to part three. For those of you that listen in the sort of 3 hours between publication and the Europa League games, especially, you've got to be quick off the draw, because Östersunds play Arsenal tonight at 6. We've mentioned Graham Potter before. It's such a wonderful story. This club, is it, they didn't exist when Wenger got the Arsenal job, or they had only been around for about 5 months. as a club.
There's quite a lot of things that didn't exist when Wenger got the Arsenal job.
That's a very good
point.
The
internet, for instance.
Arsene Wenger has called for the cup tie rule to be scrapped. Lacazette is injured. Aubameyang is cup tied because he played in the Champions League. So he hasn't even kicked a ball in the Europa League, yet he can't play.
Yeah, but Arsenal might play against Borussia Dortmund. What is Arsene babbling about?
What do we think about the cup tied rule? Agree with it? I quite like it.
Again, it's a rule. You know it's in existence. I would accept
there's something slightly weird that we don't have a problem with players moving between two clubs in a league season and potentially playing against them, and we do have a problem with it in a cup. But I assume that dates from before the transfer windows existed, and there was people could lose a semi-final and get transferred for the final. So I presume that's the origin of it. But I don't know. It seems so ingrained in our consciousness.
How key is the Europa League for Arsenal, Baz?
I think it's key to their chances of qualifying for the Champions League, but beyond that, and that's quite a big thing, but it's to lump all your eggs in that basket. But otherwise, if they don't win it, the fans will be outraged. If they do, it won't be long before the fans are outraged anyway over something else. it will have no bearing on Wenger's decision to...
Do you think it would have no bearing? Because I just sort of think that, taken as a totality, the one thing missing from his Arsenal career is a happy ending and b a European trophy. And if he could win a European trophy in France, that would seem... I mean, I know every time he wins the FA Cup, we say, it would be a perfect way to say goodbye. But this actually will be something a bit different from the FA Cup, because he's won the FA Cup, what, seven times now?
Yeah, seven times.
So to add a European trophy and to do it in Lyon.
Yeah, three finals, three losses.
They're second favourites behind Atletico Madrid.
Are they?
Yeah, they are.
Okay, all right.
They're playing on 4G, which, should that make any difference?
They'll have a great mobile phone reception.
This is a message from NYC Murphy. He writes, am I the only person who, when their brain hears the name Aubameyang, immediately goes into the Muppets' Mana Mana song? # the important stuff may have already been discussed. And I will say, you are the only person, but once you've put it in someone's mind, I literally cannot stop going Aubameyang, do-do-do-do-do now, and you guys and everyone listening... for the rest of time.
Is that actually how you say it, though? Because I've sort of been going
it's pronounced
Young. Aubameyang.
Young.
Dude. Celtic play Zenit. Other eye-catching ties.
Zenit.
So, does anyone think, or is it just me, that Östersunds are going to give Arsenal big problems and may actually beat them?
It's Östersunds, FK. Östersund. It's a genitive.
So,
I was going to ignore it, but we're on this sort of pedantry roll. I kind of felt.
There's a level of
what
pedantry.
Have I become?
There's a level of pedantry I like, which is your and a possibly RE. When it gets to that level, Wilson, I turn. I agree with Barry. Anyway, you think Arsenal are going to get hiding, do you, Baz?
No, I don't think they're going to get hiding. I have a feeling that Östersund are going to beat them in the first leg in Sweden. I could well be wrong. I hope I'm not. I just think they won't have it all their own way. They might get a scare, but they'll probably go through.
Celtic plays Zenit. Borussia Dortmund versus Atalanta. Napoli, Leipzig, Copenhagen versus Atletico de Madrid. There's some of the eye-catching ties. FA Cup fifth round this weekend. It's a draw that has the potential for lots of upsets, but until they happen, it doesn't look that exciting a draw.
It's a pretty drab draw, yeah. Mm. I'm off to Rochdale. Which is the first time I've been to Scotland. I nearly went with Whitley Bay back in 90 or 91, whenever they got to the fourth round. It'll be new ground, looking forward to that.
And a new pitch on the new ground.
Yeah, sadly, rail replacement bus service from Manchester, so that
The worst three words in the English language. Although an idea for a new book, Games You Almost Went To, Jonathan. I would buy that. I would buy that one.
I was looking at the draw of the 16 teams left in the competition. There is only one who are not either battling relegation, fighting for a title, or a more important, a European or domestic title, or a playoff place. And that team is Leicester. I think this competition is one Leicester really should try and win, because they're not going to get relegated. Their next three league games are easy. Well, easy-ish. They need, what, 4 points, if that. So they should really have a good crack at that, because every other team left in the competition, with the possibility of Sheffield Wednesday, who are almost but not quite safe in the Championship, has more important things to worry about.
So every other team at the end can say, it's probably good that we lost, but Leicester can't say that.
No. Well, West Brom and Southampton is an interesting one, because I'm sure neither of them want to have to play that game. It's nailed on going to be a draw and a replay neither of them need or want.
And Wigan Manchester City, a rematch of the 2013 final. Who scored the winner? Ben Watson, was it?
Yes.
In the last minute? Oh, that was good. If you talk to Wigan fans, they went down that year as well, I think.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And they are on that contest of staying in the Premier League or winning silverware. You talk to them or Birmingham fans with the Obafemi Martins League Cup final. Absolutely delighted that they went down, because they got that day out. They wouldn't swap it. Championship midweek. Derby slipped a defeat against Sheffield Wednesday. They lost 2-0. Cardiff are now level on points with Derby. 1 point off the top two after beating Bolton 2-0. Producer Mel will be a nervous wreck this weekend as Norwich play Ipswich in the Carrot Munchers Derby. they're both level on points in the table. Ipswich haven't beaten Norwich since April 2009. In League One, very tight at the top. Shrewsbury move back to the top after they beat Fleetwood 2-1. They're on 64 points. Wigan lost their second game in a row, defeated 2-0 at home to Blackpool. Second, level on 63 with Blackburn, who beat Portsmouth 2-1. In League Two, Luton remained 6 points clear at the top after beating Crawley 4-1. A 95th minute away winner for Cambridge United at Chesterfield. Oh. Ah, glorious. Managerless Cambridge United. That means we'll definitely stay completely in mid-table doing nothing. And Matty Taylor scored a free kick from about 200 yards out, and he's what, 96 years old, but he still looks the same. Scored a Swindon, lost 3-2 to Wickham. He's 36. Quickly before feedback corner, what do we make of England cozying up to Qatar? They could play Qatar in a friendly before the 2022 World Cup. The FA signed memorandums of understanding, whatever on earth that is, with both the Qatar Football Association and organisers of the World Cup. Less than 4 years after, the then FA chairman Greg Dyke branded the award of the game's biggest event to Qatar as the worst moment in FIFA history.
Asked for them to be stripped in 2015.
On the face of it, I can't come up with my own mind of a reason why you would do this, but is there a pragmatic mitigating?
It's brown nosing in an attempt to get the World Cup. Marina went on Twitter and she captured in a nutshell, as she always does. She said the FA's structurally doomed desperation for a World Cup recalls the great Sybil Fawlty line about Basel. You never get it right, do you? You're either crawling all over them, licking their boots, or spitting poison at them like some Benzedrine puff adder. I mean, they're an embarrassment. It's just one PR disaster after another. You know, I don't know if you ever read G's and Wooster books or seen the TV series where Bertie goes to this gentleman's club, the Drones, and any time there's, you know, he's there, it's all these adult men who should know better running around having piggyback races or food fights or, you know, pretend wrestling matches. And it's just what I imagine FAHQ to be like on a daily basis. It's, you know, how could they possibly think this is a good idea or that they won't be absolutely scorched for doing this? You know,
It almost seems too obvious. It almost seems too, you know, if you sit there going, I tell you what, lads, why don't we go to Qatar and sign a deal? And I mean, surely someone there has gone, should we write a pros and cons list?
I didn't realise that there was already a deal in place with Qatar, that Qatar have been using St George's Park. So I mean, presumably they're getting heftily paid for that, which may be the initial reason why they're doing it.
But they made no comment whatsoever about the human rights abuses, the workers, the deaths. It's just beggar's belief. Well, it shouldn't beggar belief anymore, but it does. You know, how much gas is in this FA explosion, and when are people going to be held accountable?
It's basically also going round with a begging bowl, isn't it? let's make some cash. They've got cash. Maybe we can get some of it, a bit of the action. Qataris, you know, investing in the UK economy. The Emir owning half of Mayfair. All this sort of shit.
They could put it into grassroots.
Yeah. Not in Qatar, grassroots. Doesn't work, I'm afraid. It's shameful.
Questions and feedback corner. Nikki says, we were talking about Eurovision for some reason. And we said, you know, England, UK don't do well because of politics. It was truly depressing to hear the pod roll out the line about the UK doing rubbish at Eurovision due to politics. It's a little England a myth. I was in Brighton for Song for Europe, as I also still call it, last week, and our singer this year, Sue Ree, isn't bad at all. She's performed at the Eurovision stage twice before as a dancer and a backing singer. Neil says, listening to...
I was at the Eurovision once.
Really?
1997 in Dublin.
Who was that? Gina G?
Katrina and the Waves won. Boyzone did the mid-show in turn.
Good fun, was it?
It was horrific. I was there for work reasons. And I thought, oh, well, at least I'll be able to get lashed. But as soon as it started, they closed all the bars. And then you're trapped for 5 hours.
Two football-related Eurovision facts. So one is the Iceland goalkeeper who did the video for Iceland's entry. The current Iceland goalkeeper.
Oh, yes, yes, yeah.
And the other is that when ABBA won it in Brighton in 1974, that same day, Brian Clough's Brighton lost, was it 8-2 to Bristol Rovers?
You can't ask, you can't give a fact and ask the question.
And Football Weekly have since played that same stage as...
At the Brighton Pavilion.
ABBA won the Eurovision on, yeah. I believe.
Finally, Moses says, Jonathan, what's your ideal process of conducting research for one of your football books? We don't have any more time. Day, thank you for your time.
I don't even understand what the question means.
That doesn't matter. Philippe, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Baz.
You're welcome.
Thank you properly, Jonathan.
Cheers, thank you.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.